Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The first deadline for the U.S. government to reunite migrant families separated at the border passed in late July. There are still hundreds of children in detention. And this month, the Department of Homeland Security proposed new regulations that it says would do much to relieve the problem. The regulations would allow DHS to detain families and children together with, quote, dignity and respect by terminating a 1997 court agreement. Immigration activists say the new proposal opens the door to detaining families and children indefinitely. This hour On Point, examining the government's new detention proposal for migrant families. And you can join us. What's your reaction to the administration's new proposal? Is it better to keep families together, even if that means possibly detaining them for months, years, or indefinitely? Should the government have that power? And what more needs to be done to quickly process family migrant cases at the U.S. border? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, by the way, we'll be speaking with the presumptive Democratic representative in Massachusetts, 7th Congressional District. That's Ayanna Pressley. She scored a huge upset win in the Massachusetts congressional primary this week, and we'll take a look at what that means for the Democratic Party in the midterms ahead. But first, let's talk about this new proposal from the Department of Homeland Security. And joining me now from Miami is Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
All right. So first of all, let's get sort of some of the latest numbers from you on the number of children still in detention. I mean, how many separated children has the U.S. government yet to reunite with family?
Yeah, we started with a total of about 2,600 that were originally separated. The majority of them have been reunited or handed over to relatives that their parents approved of. We're now down to about 416 parents, children who have not been reunited yet with their parents. And the majority of those, about 300, are cases where the parent was deported and the child remained back in the United States. So now they're trying to make those determinations about whether those parents want their kids returned to them in their home countries or if the parents waive their right to reunification and the children are allowed to stay in the United States to fight for asylum on their own.
Okay, so some specific questions there within what you just said. First of all, I see that some immigration attorneys and activists are concerned about those cases where the parents or the families waived their rights for reunification because they're concerned that perhaps that waiver was gained under duress.
Yeah, we have several court cases now where lawyers are saying that these parents, because it was a bit chaotic, they were reuniting these parents and with their children under court order. And when they did so, a lot of these parents are saying that they were given these very brief opportunities to make, you know, a decision that will affect them for the rest of their lives. A lot of them were saying that they weren't getting all of the information that they needed to make their decision, that they weren't given all of their options. And so what's happening now is the ACLU and a group of volunteer organizations are all working to locate these parents in these countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, to really talk to them and make sure that they made the right decision, that they knew what their options were, and to make sure that when they waived that right to reunification, that they did so knowing all of their options and making sure that they don't want to reconsider and maybe think about it again.
Okay, so but it seems a little confusing then, right? Because it's the government's responsibility to find the family members to attempt a reunification. That's under, as you said, from a court order. But you said it's the ACLU and other groups that are actually doing the searches?
Yeah, this has been a very complicated process. At first, it's been a couple of months now that the judge ordered all of these children to be reunited with their parents. They went through the quote-unquote easy ones first, the ones where both parent and child were still in the United States. And then when they started digging in on these cases, these more difficult cases where the parents had been deported, at first, the Department of Justice filed a pretty striking, stunning submission to the court suggesting that the ACLU should be wholly responsible for finding these parents and making figuring out what they want to do. The judge shut the door on that very quickly and told them, no, you guys did this. It's your responsibility to fix it. But the ACLU and these volunteer organizations do have some advantages in that they have a lot of people already on the ground down there, that these parents are a little more familiar, a little more comfortable. Let's say talking with an immigration advocate than they are with a federal government right. agent coming from the State Department. So they've been doing a lot of the legwork and just doing some amazing work, literally going from village to village, trying to verify phone numbers, trying to find addresses, and finding these parents and having those conversations with them to present them with the full range of options that they have, which aren't many, but at least let them have that conversation and make sure that they're making the right decision for their family.
Okay, so this number, just to reiterate, is that 416 or so that you said is down from the 2,500 or more that we had a couple of months ago. But for what are the specifics of what we know of the children who have been reunited? I mean, because within that large umbrella, are they reunited with parents, other family members, some in the United States? Have some just aged out? Or have others yet been adopted? I mean, where have the children who are no longer under DHS purview gone?
Yeah, and it's really a mixed bag of a lot of what you just laid out. I mean, in many in a lot of cases, they had these sort of processing sites, in mostly in Texas, where they were bringing them together. In some cases, the families were released together into the country to await their deportation hearings. In some cases, as we're seeing, the government is trying to hold them together, and we'll talk a little bit more about how the government is trying to hold these families right. together in detention. Some have aged out. In some cases, the parents were facing other criminal charges in state and federal courts. So those reunifications weren't possible because they're facing criminal charges. In some cases, the parents have allowed for their child to be released to another family member in the United States. And so it's a mixed bag of what we're looking at.
Right. Okay. So let's just sort of take a step back here and remind us how we got here, because that it's important to sort of reset that so we can knowledgeably talk about what the Trump administration is proposing now, right?
Right.
We had this zero tolerance policy coming out from DHS, from the Trump administration earlier this year. And that is what led to all these family separations, right? Because children under a 1997 court agreement cannot be detained in, under criminal proceedings in the United States for more than 20 days. Is that right?
Exactly. It was a 1997, it was called the Flores Settlement. It was a group of plaintiffs that sued the federal government, and they reached a negotiated settlement with the Clinton Justice Department that set basic minimum standards for how the United States is going to treat minors, migrant minors in its custody. It sets out very basic provisions about what kind of facilities they can be in, sort of the medical treatment, the educational needs that they have to have, counseling, healthcare, things like that. And at the heart of it, it said that the presumption should be that minors should not be held in detention, and created not a hard and fast 20-day rule, but generally speaking, that's what they've been going with, was 20 days that minors should not be in detention for more than 20 days.
Right.
The Trump administration calls that a loophole. Calls that an immigration law loophole and says that that has hamstrung them. So when they implemented zero tolerance, what happened was these family units would come over together. Let's say a mother and a son. The under zero tolerance, where before we would treat people crossing over the border in most cases as a civil violation, we're treating them criminally now under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. So that parent would have to then begin their deportation proceedings and go to and be detained indefinitely in immigration court. But because of the Flores settlement, the child could not go with that parent.
Right.
So that's where they started separating them.
So now, I mean, to be fair, multiple administrations have gone to court to try to end the terms of the Flores settlement. But now we have the Department of Homeland Security issuing a new proposal for a set of regulations that would essentially allow the Trump administration to fully withdraw from Flores completely?
Yes. Yes. So several administrations have had to separate families, just to be clear on that point. The Trump administration obviously ramped that up dramatically with their zero tolerance policy. And several administrations have tried to either limit or amend the terms of the Flores settlement. The Trump administration has tried to do that in a couple of different ways over the past year by going to courts, and they were turned down by the courts. So what they did last week is they just proposed a new rule and saying this new rule is going to supersede and eliminate the Flores settlement. And what we're going to do is we're going to honor the spirit of Flores, and we're going to make sure that these children are held in safe facilities and places that have all the medical care and all the educational care and all the family needs that are required that form the basis of Flores. But that 20-day limit goes away. And one of the key things is under Flores is that any facility that houses these families together need to be certified by the state, and that would go away under the proposed regulations. So it's sort of a trust us, we're not going to put kids in bad situations, we're going to take care of them. But obviously this is going to be immediately challenged in the courts, and so this will be before a judge before very long.
Okay, so I'm seeing in the summary of the proposal here, though, that DHS writes that the rule would create an alternative to existing licensed program requirements for family residential centers so that ICE may use appropriate facilities to detain family units together during their immigration proceedings consistent with applicable laws. Is that the part you're talking about?
Exactly. I mean, right now there are a total of three facilities in the country, two in Texas, obviously, and one in outside of Philadelphia, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And so what they're saying is that they're always at capacity in those facilities because of this surge of family units that have come across the border in recent years, that they can't house them all. So they need more facilities. That process to set up, establish, get certified a new facility under the terms of the Flores settlement, according to the government, are too cumbersome or too time consuming. So they need to be able to ramp these up more quickly while assuring, as they say, that they're going to make sure that they are safe and good for these children.
Yeah, well, in fact, the language is the rule would satisfy the basic purpose of the Flores settlement in ensuring that all juveniles in the government's custody are treated with dignity, respect, and special concern for their particular vulnerability as minors. But as Alan Gomez just said, a lot of people look upon this proposal from the Trump administration as opening the door to possibly detaining juveniles and migrant families indefinitely. So we will take a look at that when we come back. We're talking about the Trump administration's new proposal on what to do with migrant children and their families who cross the border. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the Department of Homeland Security's new proposal to allow the government to detain migrant families and children together, but possibly opens the door to detaining them indefinitely. I'm joined today by Alan Gomez. He's immigration reporter for USA Today, and he's been walking us through sort of where we are in this ongoing story and issue of separating children and families at the border. And I should say that we also reached out to the Department of Homeland Security and invited them to join us. They declined our invitation. But here's some tape from Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Senator of Iowa. There's also a legislative effort going on that's similar to the DHS proposal. We'll talk about that in a second. Senator Grassley is a co-sponsor of that effort. And here he explains his argument for repealing the so-called Flores Agreement that's behind the current challenge we're in now.
The federal government faces a stark Hobson's choice: enforce the law and separate families by releasing only the children after 20 days, or keep families together by engaging in the past administration's catch-and-release policies.
That's Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa in July. Well, joining me now is Lee Glernt, Deputy Director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project and lead attorney in a legal challenge to the Trump administration's family separation policy. Lee Glernt joins us from Washington. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you heard there that tape from Senator Grassley in July saying that the government faces a Hobson's choice and that, you know, perhaps both the legislative efforts and this DHS proposal could get them out of having to make that choice. What's your response to that?
We think that's a false choice. I mean, when you look at what the Obama administration had done at the end of the last term, it was clear that you could release families. I mean, we're talking about mothers and fathers with small children, usually release them and have them come back for their hearings. There was something called the case management program that was between 95% and 99% effective in assuring appearance. So there's no reason why we need to have a choice of separating children and indefinitely detaining them. When catch and release sounds great and you throw that out there, but that's not really what happens. There are supervision protocols. People come back for their hearing. And so we can't look at it as a burden or as a loophole when we're talking about basic constitutional rights and basic humanity, not to be detaining families, including small children, indefinitely.
Mm. Well, so tell me more about what you think about the Trump administration's proposal, because as Alan was telling us just before the break, a lot of people are looking at the proposal and saying, well, perhaps because it would allow the administration to use unlicensed facilities, that could be a problem. Do you see that?
Well, we definitely will be back in court, us or others who have litigated Flores. If this proposal goes forward, there's a lot in there that we obviously object to. We see no reason why families need to be indefinitely detained. I've just not gotten through, it's still ongoing, but, you know, 6 months of litigation over the family separation policy, that was horrific, but we don't want to see the administration turn from separating families to now indefinitely detaining them. There is so much evidence that separation traumatizes children, but indefinitely detaining children and families as well causes severe trauma. And I want to be clear about something. The focus has understandably been on children, and I think, you know, that's proper, but we do not believe that an adult can be indefinitely detained. If the adult does not pose a flight risk or a danger after some hearing is held, they need to be released as well. In this country, we don't simply indefinitely detain people for no reason. And if they're not shown to be a flight risk or a danger, they ought to be released, and we can have supervision protocols, whether it's an ankle bracelet, you know, that's an extreme measure, but if it has to be something on an ankle bracelet or a bond or check-in once a week. But we don't simply throw people in immigration jail. And keep in mind that many, many of these people are fleeing serious persecution and danger, maybe death. And then they get here, they're traumatized already. We should not be throwing them indefinitely into immigration jails.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got some comments from some On Point listeners on Facebook who would disagree with you, Lee Glernt. For example, Kevin Simmons is writing, "What's the answer? If we separate them, the media goes crazy. The parents broke the law and should be locked up for decades."
Right. Well, we are, unfortunately, actually prosecuting asylum seekers, and these parents are going to jail. We don't think that's the right answer, and it's certainly not, in our view, lawful to prosecute asylum seekers who are fleeing and have to flee any way they can. But to suggest that illegal entry should be a decades crime, yeah, we disagree with that wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are fleeing. They sometimes have no choice. They can't gather documents. But regardless, we are an obligation under domestic law and international law to provide them with asylum hearings. It can't be that we just throw people into immigration. They have a right to asylum hearings, and while they're pursuing asylum, they shouldn't be indefinitely held.
Well, let me sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but I wanted to turn back to Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He's in Miami today. And Alan, I mean, so we're focusing right now on this new proposal from the Department of Homeland Security, but I did also want to mention legislative efforts in Congress, right? Because there is a bill that's pending that would have a similar effect in terms of relieving the government's duty under the Flores Agreement. And I should say that it's a Republican proposal. We reached out to 20 co-sponsors of the bill, both on the Senate and the House side, and none of the 20 members of the GOP that we reached out to agreed to or could join us today. But Alan, what I wanted to ask you about was in the Republican legislative proposal, there is a stipulation that the government would hire more than 200, 225 new immigration judges or judging teams to help speed the processing of these cases. Would that not, you know, help the overall problem of how long these families are and would be detained?
Yeah, I mean, definitely that's one thing that would help. I mean, when we talk about indefinitely detaining these families, one of the big reasons we have to do that is because the backlog in the current immigration system is in the hundreds of thousands of cases. And so it takes them that long to go before an immigration judge and have their final hearings. And so what we see in the Republican proposal, and that's from Senator Grassley of Iowa, Senator Tillis of North Carolina, Senator Cruz of Texas, is right. It pretty much summarizes what we saw from the administration last week of trying to get out of Flores, create a separate system to house these families together indefinitely as long as they're waiting for their court hearing. But it's important to know there's also another proposal from Democrats, from Senator Kamala Harris in California, Senator Merkley in Oregon, Senator Cortez Masto in Nevada, and theirs would allow for families to be released into the U.S. if they come here seeking asylum, prevent the deportation of parents until their child's case is resolved. So until the whole family's case is resolved, nobody can be deported, and then really focus on what Lee was talking about a second ago, these alternatives to detention programs, where they more closely monitor these folks when they're released to ensure that they show up in immigration court. But yeah, the judge issue is a very important one. Just yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions swore in about 44 new judges to add to the 330 that we have working right now, in an effort to speed through these cases and get more of them resolved more quickly.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Alan, because we actually have some tape of the remarks that Attorney General Sessions made while swearing in those new judges. He defended the Trump administration's immigration policy. Again, this is in Falls Church, Virginia, just yesterday.
It is perfectly legitimate, moral, and decent for a nation to have a legal system of immigration and to enforce the system that it lawfully adopts. No great and prosperous nation can have both a generous welfare system and great prosperity and open borders. Such a policy is both radical, it's dangerous.
Lee Gelernt, you're with the ACLU. Respond to what you just heard the Attorney General say.
Right. Well, I think, you know, again, the administration is setting up a false dichotomy. No one is suggesting, at least we are not, calling for open borders, right? So people can enforce, the administration can enforce border security just the way every administration's done. The question is how they do it, right? And so this administration decided, unlike every prior administration, Democratic or Republican, that they were going to take children away from their parents, including babies. I mean, we had children who were 4 months old, 5 months old, being ripped from their children. Now they want to have indefinite detention.
So, well, I mean, part of the reason, again, as Attorney General Sessions reiterated yesterday, is the Trump administration believes asylum rules are being abused by some migrants who seek to come to this country.
Right, but that does not mean, even if true, that you say we're going to take away children, we're going to indefinitely detain. I think that, you know, the public has spoken and said, look, this is just too far. We don't need to take those steps in order to enforce our immigration laws. And one thing that I think people should be clear about is that not only is it inhumane to take a baby away from their parents and send the baby halfway across the country or to indefinitely detain families who are seeking asylum. But it's not actually a deterrent. You know, when I've been representing these families who were separated, and when I talk to the parents afterward and I ask them, you know, would you have come anyway if you had known your child was going to be taken away? They just throw up their arms and shrug and say, what choice did I have? I couldn't stay. My child would have been killed or could have been killed. I could have been killed. And so it's not actually a deterrent. And I think what brings people to this country are different forces, including seeking asylum. And we ought to be providing a fair hearing. And when they get here traumatized, they ought not to be indefinitely detained or have their children taken away.
I just need to jump in here for a second because we do have callers who want to join us, and I don't mean to be ignoring them. Kathy is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Kathy, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for my call. I'll make it brief. I listen to everything that everyone has said, and I truly, my heart goes out to these families. Most families who immigrate and come over here, they know exactly what the problems are and what they might, what might be imposed on their families. What I guess I'm most concerned about is from teaching over 30 years, and I see so much incarceration of just on my American citizens and how much money I have to give or I'm willing to give to help families, to help get the children who need to go to other people's families. I feel like I'm being extended. I don't have enough money myself to give to help these people, and that's where the money's coming from. The United States citizens are being their taxes are taken. You know, we're trying to help everybody. There just has to be a more comprehensive plan. There's got to be better thinkers out there in our country that can help solve both the incarceration problems with our own citizens and for these people coming to seek asylum.
Kathy, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thank you so very much for your call. Let's go to Kata, who's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Kata.
Hi. I'm appalled as a psychologist, mother and grandmother, at what is happening to families, and I really think it's really racism and bigotry at work. And that other caller that just came in about our taxes are paying for this, I know that a lot of corporations are making a lot of money on detention centers, and definitely there are private corporations running jails. So big money is probably backing a lot of what's going on. Mm. I think it's disgusting in terms of our humanity as Americans, as an immigrant nation, as a melting pot, that we are doing this to families. I had sleepless nights thinking about this.
Yeah.
And I am appalled and disgraced as an American.
Well, Kata, thank you so much for your call. Alan Gomez, let me turn back to you there. You heard sort of lots of difference of opinions of where we have been with this issue and where we are now. I mean, Lee Glernt was telling us that the ACLU is almost certainly going to be challenging this new regulation or proposal in court. I mean, what could happen there?
Yeah, and I'll say, I think both callers raised interesting points. They talked about the economics of immigration, the detention industry, the effect it has there. We're talking now specifically about how to treat these families coming over. And I think what it all gets to is the one thing that everybody agrees with in the immigration debate, and that is that Congress needs to get together and work on a comprehensive solution to update what is now a 50-year-old immigration system that's only been tweaked over the decades. And that's as somebody who's covered immigration for a very long time. 2013 was the last time that Congress came close to passing something like this. But all of these problems, this family separation issue, there should be hearings. There should be something going on in Washington to get to a rational place with this. And I think that's one of the frustrations that folks on both sides have, that because of the politics of it, and especially this being an election year, the odds of Senator Grassley's proposal or the Democratic proposal when it comes to family separation, not very high hopes that anything like that will even get a hearing in Congress. And obviously the broader question of comprehensive immigration reform, zero chance that we're going to see anything like that moving.
But Alan, we've just got a minute to go here. I mean, would this proposal to withdraw from Flores entirely get us closer to that sort of that state of rationality you're talking about? Because I'm seeing here that Perhaps not. The administration is projecting that ICE-run family detention centers could increase from 3,000 beds to 12,000 beds. And then they'd also have to increase the number of shelters for unaccompanied immigrant minors.
Yeah, I mean, if the Grassley proposal were to pass as is, we would be having a whole different debate in this country about having minors in detention for months or years at a time. So that raises all sorts of other issues. I guess the only point I was trying to make is it would be lovely to have Republicans and Democrats sit together and try to figure out some sort of compromise that addresses the concerns of both sides.
Legal Alert, we've just got about 30 seconds here. Last thought goes to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one quick point about the caller. And the economics. I think when you look at it, the economics clearly favor some solution other than indefinite detention. Detaining these families costs a fortune. There are ways, alternatives to detention that can assure their appearance and cost much less. So if we're looking at just the economics, it clearly doesn't make sense to be indefinitely detaining these families.
Yeah. Well, Legal Alert is Deputy Director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project joining us today from Washington. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, with us from Miami. Alan, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We got lots of different views coming in online. D. Kieft is tweeting us saying, isn't this called internment? Does this administration have any compassion or empathy for children seeking a better life? Whereas Nelson Law says, liberals think that illegal aliens with children must be exempt from immigration laws. This short-term solution is not working in solving a long-term problem. When we come back, we'll talk more about what a Massachusetts congressional primary says about the battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate. Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
To our immigrants worried about the knock on the door, change can't wait. To women whose rights are perpetually under attack, change can't wait.
Well, that is Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley and her huge upset victory in a Massachusetts Democratic congressional primary earlier this month. Pressley ran against Michael Capuano, a 10-term incumbent and also a progressive Democrat who differed very little from Pressley in terms of politics and policy. Nevertheless, voters overwhelmingly picked Pressley in a landslide 59-41 win, seemingly enthusiastic about the idea of swapping the experience that comes with incumbency for the experiences that come with a different kind of life. Pressley is the presumptive congresswoman-elect from Massachusetts' 7th District, and that is because there is no Republican running against her in the general election in November. So she will almost certainly become the first black woman to represent Massachusetts in Congress. Now, her win follows Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's congressional primary victory in New York and Andrew Gillum's gubernatorial primary win in Florida. So is the restive energy in the Democratic base turning into something that looks like a viable insurgency? Well, joining us now in the studio is Ayanna Pressley. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again, Meghna.
Okay. So first of all, maybe folks on the internet saw this video of you when you were first told that you had won this congressional primary. It's almost like a meme now of women being surprised that they've won in these insurgent campaigns. I mean, you look genuinely shocked in that video. How shocked were you?
It was a purely authentic, organic amazement. I was stunned. I had been readying myself immediately before my aide came in to take the stage in defeat. and was sort of readying myself for what I was going to say to this room, because I knew I had seen and felt what we were building out there. And I saw, especially millennials, many of whom had been in a fetal position since 2016, who had come out, and we had restored their hope. And then there were many who had never participated or been engaged in the process, who we had given hope. And I was sitting there thinking, I've written one speech, it has to work either way, and I'm not sure we pulled this out. And so how do I look into this audience and find a way to maintain the hope that we have given or restored?
You were preparing yourself for defeat, but your victory was 59-41. I think, you know, for a lot of political observers in Massachusetts and around the country, you know, at best, people were thinking it was going to be close. I mean, what does that blowout tell you about what people, you know, at least in this particular Massachusetts district, are looking for?
Well, it confirms some of what I already knew, which is that polling undersamples the electorate that we were working actively to engage.
These are people who are not necessarily likely voters.
Correct. And again, even I knew we had a path to victory, but I was prepared to lose, but I knew we had a path to victory. And I was sitting in, the victory ultimately will be that we have changed the way electoral politics and campaigns will be done for the future. We ushered in a new paradigm shift. And I think it proves that, one, you cannot gauge transformation. And there was a shift occurring. We could feel it beneath our feet out there. When I went to a shelter to spend time with women experiencing homelessness, and one of them, as I entered, said, I love your number one bus video. And I can't wait to vote for you because change can't wait. I said, something is happening.
This is a campaign video that you put out
about the disparities,
the income disparities,
correct,
across this particular Massachusetts district.
That I felt could be summed up in a bus ride from Cambridge to Roxbury. And so when I had 14-year-olds that were canvassing on days that it was quite literally like walking the surface of the sun, and 250 incarcerated black men at MCI Norfolk endorsed my candidacy and were organizing their families on the outside, I said a shift is occurring.
Yeah, but I don't know, Preston, let me ask you something. I mean, you said on the on voting day that you do feel as if this particular race was yet another one that was emblematic of this battle going on for the soul of the Democratic Party. But I do wonder how much folks should actually read into your victory, because there are some, you know, things about the 7th Massachusetts district in particular. I mean, it's the state's only majority minority district. It is a very, very reliably blue district. I mean, you on the campaign trail were talking about how it's, you know, the former seat for John F. Kennedy, Tip O'Neill, et cetera. And in fact, on the campaign trail, you said, if Democrats can't embrace being bold here in this particular district, where can they? So my question for you is, regarding the battle of the soul for the Democratic Party, I mean, isn't the 7th Massachusetts district somewhat of an outlier? I mean, is that same battle going on in more centrist districts across the country? How much should we reading into your victory?
I think the battle in this race, and there were policy differences between myself and my opponent, and there were campaign differences. We didn't accept corporate PAC money. We raised $1 million in grassroots donations. I was calling for the defunding and the abolishing of ICE. I was spotlighting different issues relative to disparity and inequality. But I think ultimately this was a generational shift, less of an ideological one, although I think it was a style difference. I was running on bold, visionary activist leadership. As I have said repeatedly since Tuesday, one week ago today, that I think our victory was less a referendum against hate and more a mandate for hope. Our campaign was not just about the resistance of resisting Trump and the policies of he and his administration. I don't feel as a Democrat, because we're in the minority and especially sitting in the 7th seat, that we should be putting our hope and our aspiration and vision for this district on a shelf because we're in the minority. I'm not going to treat Kavanaugh as an inevitability, no matter how sobering the landscape. We had a phone bank at my headquarters last night to lobby senators. And so I think what was deeply resonant and transcendent is that I was offering bold, visionary, activist leadership, which was giving people hope. And that was not a lot of the messaging that was happening in many other campaigns.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering about is perhaps the Massachusetts 7th District has a high appetite and desire for that kind of activist leadership that you were campaigning on. But, you know, like people across the country are wondering what direction the Democratic Party as a whole is going to go.
I'm wondering.
Do you see that same appetite elsewhere or not?
I think wherever you are, we are still in the midst of, I called it on the trail an identity crisis, and that might be too dramatic an offering, but we need to get it straight. I do think that we are presenting false choices to one another internally in the party. I reject that this is about working class white voters versus everyone else. I reject that this is about jobs in the economy or criminal justice reform. Our destinies are tied. We are a big tent. There are many seats at the table of democracy. And the silver lining of this administration has been that our organizing silos are breaking down. And so to me, we are at a crossroads as a party. And this can be our darkest hour or our finest. And I think it's our finest if we sit in the place of coalition and movement building. We don't pawn off the hurt on one constituency at a time. We say that we are going to stand for trans rights. We're going to stand for immigrants' rights. We're going to stand for women's rights. We're going to stand for workers' rights. That is who we are. So the fight for the soul of the party is a return to who we have always been foundationally. And it is a resurrection of those foundational premises.
So this is really interesting because, I mean, now you're, you know, presuming all goes as expected in November in the general, you'll be heading to Washington. But I'm curious about whether or not party leadership sees this moment in the same way that you and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others see this moment. And here's why I ask, because, you know, for example, you know, we after the Alabama Senate special election and last year's Virginia gubernatorial race, there were a lot of headlines that said things like, quote, the Democratic Party owes black female voters a big thank you. Like lots of talk about how African-American women are at the heart of the Democratic Party right now. But in this race, in your race against Michael Capuano, when it came to endorsing or supporting your candidacy, I got a list here. The Congressional Black Caucus's PAC endorsed Capuano. Representative Gregory Meeks told the New York Times that we've got nothing against the challenger. That was you. But when you have a colleague that's done the right thing for 20 years, you work with him. We know him. Congressman John Lewis even campaigned in Boston for Capuano. And he said, in Boston, it's important to keep a leader, a fighter, and a warrior like Mike Capuano around. Former Governor Deval Patrick also endorsed him. It's my long-winded way of saying, if there is a battle going on for the future of the Democratic Party, do you think the Democratic establishment, the Democratic leadership represents that and what or recognizes that? And what lessons ought they learn from your victory?
Yeah, Meghna, this race and our victory has garnered national attention. I do believe it will become a case study in many ways. Again, I think it is a bellwether, and I hope it will prompt us to shift course and to throw away assumptions of who is a likely voter and to invest the resources to engage everyone. Secondly, I think we will, a lot of organizations are going to have to reexamine their litmus test and that perhaps there will not be an immediate default to incumbency, that perhaps there will be a more equal weight given to considering a candidate and their bona fides and what they have to contribute and what their message is. I think that polling completely goes out the window in terms of the viability test. I hope that what we will see a shift is in how campaigns are run and won and the candidates that are embraced. And I should add, so far as the CBC PAC and so many others, they were amongst the first calls that I received election
after
night.
After
Congressman
the
Lewis probably called me, you know, 30 minutes after we announced. And so I'll be in D.C. this week for Congressional Black Caucus Week. They are embracing me with open arms and looking forward to governing with me.
Ayanna Pressley, I want to ask you something looking forward here, because I'm seeing some parallels, broadly speaking, between what's going on now with Democrats versus what went on, say, in 2010 with the Tea Party and insurgents in the Republican Party. And I just wanted to see what you think about this, because one of the reasons why I think Tea Party Republicans have been so effective is not only did they get elected, but once they won their races and were in office, they formed a really influential caucus, sometimes to the chagrin of Republican leadership. They really sort of stood their ground on issues they believed in. And I'm wondering, you know, in order to really drive your agenda and your activist ideas that you say you want to bring to Washington, are you and perhaps other, we'll see who gets elected in November, but other newly elected Democrats sort of willing to do the same?
I think it's certainly a conversation worth having. We'll see after the midterms who's standing and where there's that natural alignment of value and policy priority. Certainly there is strength in numbers, and we'll be more effective if we can be in coalition and tactical in that way. But I want to just continue to underscore how important it is to me to be in community and organizing with residents in the Massachusetts 7th. If you look at the Affordable Care Act, and I also think this was a resonant message of our campaign, that was ultimately saved, not because of the conviction of lawmakers, but because of the courage of individuals and families who went to Washington, who organized, who mobilized, and who forced the hands of lawmakers to do the right thing by them because they knew that lives were quite literally hanging in the balance. This is what I ran on, is the need for us to have activist leadership, someone that will coalition and movement build and extend a hand of partnership. That is what these times require. That is what the district deserves. And so I very much hope to have the opportunity to tactically organize and to be in coalition with my colleagues that are of like minds in Congress. But what I will never lose sight of is the fact that it is my job to lift up the stories and the struggles of the people in the Massachusetts 7th, to harness their innovation and their ideas, and to do this work in partnership with them. That is the thing that was the most resonant and continued. Just this morning, I was doing thank you standouts throughout the Massachusetts 7th, just shaking hands and hugging people and thanking them for what they've entrusted me with. This is an awesome responsibility. I don't think I've even connected to the electoral victory because I've just been focused on the awesome responsibility and the work that lies ahead and making sure that I'm doing my part to restore the hope and the trust and the confidence that we've earned. And what people were responding to over and over again was, and people just cried, especially the millennials, they just cried, thank you for giving us hope and thank you for making me feel empowered. Because they were feeling incredibly defeated and dispirited. And so we have to organize, we have to mobilize and be in coalition.
You know, I hear you and your focus on the people who you will soon be representing in Congress. But, you know, we just got a minute left to go here, Ayanna Pressley. I keep coming back to this question. I mean, do you think that the restiveness that was communicated in this particular primary in Massachusetts, I mean, is it emblematic of what's happening elsewhere, or is your victory an outlier for Democrats?
I think it's a shift. I feel a paradigm shift, and I am proud to have played a role in ushering in that shift, which I do believe is generational, but is also about the practice of governance and how we do this work and how we run campaigns. Again, no corporate PAC money, investment in ethnic and specialty media, expanding the electorate. Every constituency that people would consider to be flux or unreliable delivered for us. And that is because we treated them as an equal partner. And so I hope that those are the takeaways, and we will be sure to bring that message to Washington. And I do think that there is an appetite, not only from the electorate, but in leadership for this shift. Otherwise.
Otherwise. ellipses.
I think there are many takeaways and notes, and people, you know, are going to build new muscle and build it quickly.
Well, we'll see if that happens. Ayanna Pressley, she is the presumptive Democratic representative from Massachusetts' 7th Congressional District. We say presumptive because no Republican is running against her in the November general election. She won a surprise landslide victory against a 10-term incumbent in the state's primary earlier this month. Ayanna Pressley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.